Tango Tango Papa 1803, December 4, 2013.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Nashville, Illinois. So I dropped and hooked in Kansas City, Kansas, I guess early yesterday evening. And then they didn't send a load, so I got the trailer, went over to the Missouri side to a truck wash and got the trailer washed out. And still no load, so I went to the Crete yard there in Kansas City, which is near, not too far from the truck wash, just a few miles. So I went there and spent the night, and then this morning there was still no load. And then there was a message that came through, and they basically, it was one of these random drug tests. So they said, when your break is finished, check into the office after it opens, and because they have a little office there at that yard, an office and a shop. And call us from then. Of course, they said, and when I called, the woman said, well, check in with the women that are working in there and tell them you're here for a drug test and so on and so forth. So I did, and you pee in the cup and done that many times. Then afterwards, I went back out to the truck and still no load. They finally sent a load. It was after, I guess it was after 12 o'clock, or it was somewhere around 12 o'clock. They did send a load, or I guess it was after that. And then that load picked up in Marshall, Missouri, and it delivers to Albertville, Alabama. And so I made it here to Nashville, Illinois, which is about, I don't know, probably 50 miles into Illinois after you cross from St. Louis, Missouri into the Illinois side. Then it's about 50 miles from there or so. So I stopped here. There's a truck stop that's been here for quite a few years, and that leaves me, I don't know, I can't quite, sorry about that. Let me look and see, what does that say? It says 404 miles. So I have 404 miles to go to make it to Albertville, Alabama. And then the load delivers, today was the 4th, so we have the 5th, which is Thursday. And then it delivers Friday at 10:30 a.m. So I've got all day tomorrow to drive 404 miles, which should be able to do that without too much trouble. So weather-wise, it's getting colder now. When I in Kansas City this morning, it was probably 39 degrees, and it was drizzling a little bit, and there was a little breeze, and so it was kind of cold, very damp. And then it was somewhat warmer at Marshall, Missouri, which is about roughly 90 miles away, or maybe a little less than that. It was about 48 degrees, but the wind was blowing harder, and it was still really overcast and damp and with periodic drizzle. So I'm guessing that the wind chill would have probably been in the 20s there at Marshall. And then so now here this evening, where I've stopped at here at Nashville, Illinois, let me see what this says. I'm looking at the widget on my phone. if I can get it to, okay, there it goes. So it says it's 60 degrees, and but it's supposed to get down to 36 degrees, and I'm not sure exactly when that's going to happen. Maybe more towards morning, later, or you know, kind of mid-morning, it's going to get cooler. But there is a kind of cold air that's obviously on the way, and you know, it's getting ready to kind of cover a large portion of the country, so, and bring different weather with it. So by the time, let's see, so I think when I looked earlier, it said it for Albertville, Alabama, I think Friday evening it's supposed to get down into the 30s, but there's daytime highs will still be in the 60s, so it'll get somewhat cooler there, but I think the cooler weather is going to kind of stall out, at least according to what I looked at earlier today for Albertville, Alabama. So anyway, what I have, I've got my Audible book. You know, I'm in the one book per month club with Audible, so the Audible book that I got this for the month of December, you know, I had this, you know, I'm like one credit per month I pay for. And so the book that I got, the other day I played the audio from it was kind of a shortened version of a TED Talk where this female author from New York City of Chinese heritage she was talking about, she had written this book called Factory Girls. And it was about the women that work in Chinese factories, mostly women. It's a large percentage of women that work in these factories, about 70 to 70% female in a lot of cases. And so it's not, you know, so the book is very interesting. So I got that audiobook. It's the unabridged version. It's about 15 hours long and something, and I'm still listening, and still in the process of listening to it. Been listening to it, you know, kind of on and off yesterday and today. And it's quite fascinating. There's this image that we have that's kind of been portrayed in the media that, you know, that the people that are working in these factories are prisoners and so on and so forth, and or they're virtual prisoners and they're working in terrible conditions and so on and so forth. And, you know, and they're working for just, you know, tiny wages and so on. And you know the drill. If you've watched any of those shows, you kind of know the image that's been portrayed. So what this book does, this book was, I think she wrote the book probably around 2005. But in any case, she goes into a lot of history. This gal, you know, her own parents originally were Chinese, and they left China. They came to, you know, I think sometime in the 60s, right before the Cultural Revolution started, so-called Cultural Revolution, started in China, which was madness, basically. And so her parents came to the United States, and her dad was a professor and so on and so forth. So she was born and raised in New York City. But in any case, she moved to China and lived there for a number of years. And then she, you know, and then she wrote this book. And the book it's fascinating. Migration and all these factories, at least in the modern age, kind of started in the 90s. And I don't know how many people really are aware of that. You know, you think it's more of a recent thing, but it's been going on for some time now. You know, probably at least upwards of 25 years or more. This current wave of Chinese factories and so on and so forth. But it's very interesting because these people are not slaves in the way that you think they are. They're not being you know, they're there voluntarily. They're there to earn money. And so this gal that wrote the book spent a bunch of time with made friends with different women that were working in these factories, even to the extent that she even went home with them. You know, sometimes they'd go home every couple of years to go, you know, to visit their parents back in the farm, because most of them are coming from farm, you know, like farm communities, rural China. And then, you know, there's like 120 million of them that migrate to the cities, you know, and work. And then they go, you know, they'll go home every couple of years maybe or whatever. And, of course, they end up, in many cases, they'll end up living in the factories. The factories have dormitories. Or, you know, if they kind of move up in economic circumstance and they get their own apartments and, you know, so on and so forth. But it's very interesting. And so this gal even went home with the part I just listened to. She went home with this one. This gal went, you know, had been gone for a couple of years, and she went home to visit, you know, for like Chinese New Year. As a lot of them go home on Chinese New Year, and, you know, that's kind of a holiday, and they go home and spend several days at home and then come back to work, you know, come back to the city to work. So this author went home with one of them and spent the, you know, spent the holiday with, you know, and so she's describing in great detail, you know, what these people, how they live their lives, and they, you know, they don't have any, basically they don't have any heat in their houses, and they, you know, it's cold, and they're wearing coats and gloves, and, you know, and apart from the, you know, it doesn't take much farming in order to keep themselves fed. So the biggest activity that they have in rural China is, guess what? It's watching television. She said, or in this book, she says the television was always playing at full volume, 20, you know, just on all the time. You know, and these people just throw their trash in the floor, and periodically someone will sweep it up. You know, so it's different culture, you know. Besides, the big problem with China, as it is with every other, you know, every other country, you've got people that are really super suggestible, and that's how that, you know, cultural revolution kind of took hold. Because once you have too many people that are too suggestible in a society, then people cannot speak up anymore. You know, when injustice kind of comes along, they cannot speak up. And the only time they'll actually speak up is sort of in mob form. So it's sort of exactly backwards. So they'll speak up when they shouldn't, and they keep quiet when they should speak up. But you have these mad ideas that take over. So that, you know, this cultural revolution, you know, the idea was we're just going to completely wipe out the past, and no, you know, anything that's traditional, we're just going to completely wipe it out and start over. You know, and then we'll have, you know, maybe like you're going to just get rid of any tradition, and you know, and anything that's traditional is bad, and so therefore we're just going to completely start over from scratch, you know, with nothing to replace it. You know, so, it was, you know, China went through this 10-year period where, you know, it's basically insanity. And so I've got some audio that I want to play about that from that I found on YouTube. But so this book is, I highly recommend it. You know, what you think you know about China is, you know, it's really not what you think it is. You know, China's had a very long history. And it's very different from what, you know, what we've been led to believe that it is, as far as a nation. It's a very different kind of place than what you think. And, you know, these people that are working in these factories are, you know, they're look, you know, they're from, you know, in their culture and from their viewpoint, they're moving ahead in the world. You know, working in all these factories, making all these different parts for different things, they're actually, their goal is to move forward in the world. And so for many of them, they actually are kind of leaving, you know, they sort of leave the farming life behind, and you know, they're for better or for worse, they're sort of moving into, you know, sort of an urban, big city type life, you know, and it's been called the largest migration of people in history. Now, in some cases, you know, traditionally they would go back, maybe after they get a certain age, they'd go back home and live for a while. But in many cases, I think now they just, at some point they can go back and visit. But it's they're so used to, the life is actually much better in cities because they have running water and heating and air conditioning and so on and so forth. And on the, you know, in those rural farm communities that they, you know, rural villages that they come from, don't have those things. And you know, they do have, I guess they do have electricity, but they use it very sparingly because it's very expensive. So these migrant workers that are coming to the cities and, you know, working are sending, in a lot of cases, they're sending money or taking money back to their parents. You know, and you hear these stories, oh, they're only making $200 a month. Well, what you have to understand, you know, if you're going to convert the yuan, the Chinese yuan, into dollars, one yuan equals, at least during the writing of this, it equaled about 12 cents or 12 and a half cents. So, but what you have to, you can't really do a direct comparison between dollars and you know, in this case it was yuan. You can't do a direct comparison. What you have to do is, you know, look at the, you know, what is the cost of living in the yuan, you know, in the Chinese currency? What's the cost of living? You know, and so these people all have, they've all got cell phones and they're saving their money and so on and so forth. And, you know, for different prices, they can rent apartments or they can, you know, buy vehicles or whatever it is they want to do. So you have to look at it in terms of what things cost in the currency. You can't do a dollar, you know, a direct currency comparison, because that you'll end up with an incorrect, you'll end up with a very incorrect comparison. So anyway, so I've got some audio from some videos that I found on YouTube, so we'll start with those. But before I play something, I just remembered today there was this headline, and a couple of different people brought it to my attention, but at least three people. But in any case, there's a story out there today that New York City, a truck going into New York City, now they're charging a truck a $102 toll to go over the George Washington Bridge. Now, a lot of people probably were not aware of it, but, you know, back, oh gosh, years ago, the toll was like $50, you know, and most people that are driving in their cars have no clue that even then, you know, trucks that were crossing those bridges, those toll bridges into New York City, were paying that much just to cross in. So, you know, it was $50 back way back in the 80s. So I just assumed, you know, it would probably, I didn't know what it was because I don't have to, you know, anymore. It's just all handled by Easy Pass. So I really don't know what the toll is. I'm not putting out any cash. Again, fortunately, I don't have to go to New York City. It's pretty rare that I do. So I think it's actually a good thing. I hope they double it. I think that $102 is too cheap. They should double it to $204. I guess it's been, you know, they raised it from 90, it was 90 something for a truck to cross, and now they've jacked it up to 102. So, but I'd assume that it was probably at least 75, you know, without even knowing. So, but I hope they raise it. I want them to raise it because it makes it less likely that I will have to go into that place. I think that's why I think they should double it. They're not charging enough. You know, I'm really serious. They should raise it because the people that are living there are paying for it anyway. You know, it's just you have this idea, oh, the truck drivers are going to have to pay. Or you feel sorry for the poor truck drivers. They have to pay this high toll. Well, ultimately, who pays for the truck drivers? Who pays for the where does the value, you know, the product come from? You know, who pays for that? In other words, who trades for that? And what is traded? And so, ultimately, the people that are living there, that are actually producing things, if they want their stuff, then they'll end up paying to get it. And ultimately, you know, trucking company that can't make a profit above and beyond the cost of doing business. In this case, you'd have the cost of bringing a load into New York City. A trucking company that can't do that and make a profit won't survive, and they don't deserve to survive. So I think that New York City should raise it. $102 isn't high enough. I want it to be higher. I want the barrier to be impossibly high, really reducing the likelihood that I'll have to go into that. It's a hellhole. And I know the people in New York City think there are people that think it's the most magnificent city in the world, the greatest city in the world, they say. I think it's a hellhole. Want to know what a little taste of what hell's like? You go to New York City and get a little taste of it. So I think they should raise it up higher. I don't think their tolls are not high enough. They need to be higher. Double it, triple it. So, anyway, I've got some different pieces of audio that I found from videos on YouTube. Now, this first one I'm going to play, it's about the Chinese. This guy he's got 10 facts about China, and this is about 5 minutes and 25 seconds. So we'll go ahead and play this, and I started watching the first part of it, and I decided that I would want the audio from it, and so I haven't. So we're going to be kind of listening to most of this together. So here is the 10 facts about China.
Hi guys, Mark here with Walter's World. We're in the Beihai Park, right by the Forbidden City in Beijing. And today we're going to give you 10 things that are going to shock you when you come to China. This is more for Westerners when they come. You might not be ready for these things. So I'm just going to give you a heads up. So when you come, it's not a shock. You're used to it, and it won't surprise you, okay? So the first thing you need to know about are the toilets. First off, it's going to be a hole in the ground most of the time. Just be prepared for that. So get your squatting ready. So women wear dresses, skirts, stuff like that makes it easier. Guys, good luck. We have a video actually helping you know the bathrooms here. Okay, so just know it's going to be a hole. Also, there's no toilet paper in the stalls. Okay, so you got to bring your toilet paper with you, or it's at the doorway when you walk into the bathroom. Also, the bathroom, when you go to the toilet part, there's a step up, so be careful. You don't want to trip and fall in the toilet here. Not fun. Okay, so that's the first thing that's going to shock you, are the toilets. The second thing you're going to shock you about here is how much people spit, and it's not just two, it's two. I mean, my son Caleb, I spit the other day. He's like, Daddy, you're not doing it right. You got to do it. Two. guys, people do spit, clear their throat, because you have so much air pollution and stuff like that, that you will be spitting too. So just be prepared to hear a lot of kind of things on the train, on the metro, in the streets, all kinds of stuff like that. Men, women, kids, pretty girls, all kinds of people. The third thing that's going to shock you is how bad the smog can be. Now, today we got a beautiful day here in Beijing, but the first 2 days we were here, it was literally brown. We couldn't see the buildings across the street. The smog, when it's bad, will shock you how bad it truly is. And in the country, if you go to the countryside, we came from Xi'an to Beijing. It's about 1,000 kilometers. It was literally smog the whole way, and you will be shocked how bad the air quality can be. But then when you get days like today, you don't notice and you don't care because it is beautiful and you can actually breathe clearly. But make sure you bring some masks from the U.S. or wherever you're coming from, okay? Number four thing that's going to shock you is the food. Yes, you can get dog meat here, and yes, you can get donkey meat. Donkey meat's actually not too bad. Dog meat, I couldn't bring myself to eat. I tried, but I just couldn't do it, okay? But there are pretty crazy stuff you can have here. Mountain lion, if you like. Turtle soup or all kinds of things you can't eat that you're not used to at home. And so it will shock you, some of the stuff on the menus. Now, those kind of things, dog, donkey, things like that, they're not at every restaurant, so don't worry, okay? But just be prepared that some of these things might pop up in the menu, okay? So sometimes I order food and I'm like, I don't know what it is, and I don't want to know what it is. It just tastes good. I don't want to know, okay? The fifth thing that's going to shock you about China are the lines. Or I should say the lack of lines. There's so many people, that's just a mad rush all the time for a line. So if you're going into the metro in Beijing or Shanghai or getting off, everyone goes at the same time. They don't let people off and then other people come in. The elevator works the same way. It's just a mad rush in and out. And if you're going in line for anything, whether you're buying ice cream or candies or anything like that, you're going to have that same bam rush kind of thing. So be prepared for, you know, don't leave any space in that line. Be right up on the person in front of you because someone will sneak in front of you. Guaranteed, and that's going to shock you, the lack of lines. Hong Kong, they have lines, don't worry, but mainland, forget about it, okay? The sixth thing that's going to shock you about coming to China is people. There are people everywhere. Guys, there's 1.5 billion Chinese people, okay? So that's five for every one American. So if you're in the U.S., for every place you go, imagine there's five people there instead of just you. Okay, so you have things like that. So you are going to be surprised how many people there really are and how they really are on top of each other and all over the places and the rickshaws and the bikes and the cars and all kinds of stuff. So be prepared for that to shock you. But it is kind of cool because there are people everywhere, so you're never kind of alone. But it is really safe here. So even though you're not alone, you're still safe. So it's really cool. The seventh thing you're going to be shocked about here is how much they love Western babies. Our kids literally get their picture taken a few hundred times a day. I mean, people are taking pictures of me doing these videos. Okay, but like my kids, they get mobbed because they're little Western kids and people love to take pictures of them. So if you're coming with your kids, be prepared for this, okay? Doesn't matter how cute you think they are, the Chinese guys think they're even cuter, okay? So be prepared for that because that will shock you. The eighth thing that's going to shock you about coming to China is the traffic. Guys, traffic goes all the time. Cars going each way, buses and rickshaws and bikes and people and all kinds of stuff. You have to look the entire time when you're crossing. If you don't know how to cross the street, get with a group of Chinese people and wait for them to cross and follow them. And while you go, keep looking because the cars and the buses, they won't stop for you. They'll hit you. Okay, so you really got to pay attention. So sometimes you stop in the middle and you like weave your way through. So be ready for that. So that'll kind of shock you when you're here. The ninth thing that's going to shock you, and for parents this is one of those things, is you'll see little kids pooping and peeing on the streets. And you'll see little kids and they'll have slits in the back of their pants and they'll just squat down and take a dump or take a pee, you know, and the parents just leave it there. Sometimes, like my son, he kept asking about it until he saw at the Forbidden City a dad holding his kid up and the kid's pooping into the trash can through his crack in the pants. And my son never talks about poop anymore. That traumatized. So be prepared for that shock of seeing little kids poop and pee. You don't see so much of that in Shanghai and Beijing, but you will see a lot once you get out of the major cities. So just be prepared that it might not be doggy doo-doo on the road. It might be Dougie's doo-doo, okay? And the 10th thing that's going to shock you about coming to China is just really how wonderful the people are. Because I'll be honest, the Chinese people here are fantastic. They're friendly. They're helpful. Even if they don't speak English, they're still going to try to help you out and get you where you want to go. And it is great. And I've really enjoyed it. That's been my favorite part of China, is meeting the people and seeing how wonderful they really are. And I hope you get to meet a lot of Chinese people when you come to China. It is a great place to visit. If you want to know more things, five things you love and hate about visiting Beijing, top 10 cities in China, check us out at our website at waltersworld.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, and we appreciate all of our likes and subscriptions. And bye from the Beihai Park in Beijing, China. Bye.
Okay, so there, that was pretty interesting. 10 things that will shock you about China. And all of those are pretty much cultural things. So, very interesting. It's a different world. 1.2 billion people. And they're all suggestible to varying degrees. So, could be a very dangerous place to be, even if you're Chinese. Okay, so I've got another file here. And this one, It's about 5 minutes or so, and it's about the Cultural Revolution.
What then did actually happen in China? And who are these strange revolutionaries? What did they know of Mao Zedong's real intentions? From where did such religious fanaticism come? Such blind readiness to destroy the party and state apparatus, to disorganize the world order? No, they are not revolutionaries, and they knew nothing of the insidious plans of the Maoists. Their hysteria was artificially incited, otherwise the mock cultural revolution would not have taken place. Millions of youngsters were simply hoodwinked, and the Chinese people could only silently criticize their deeds. Ancient Chinese had a toy, a blockhead, which personified humiliating limited dunderheads. Don't think. This is done for you by the reddest of all red suns. Do everything he says. Understand? If you don't, you will later. It's hard to imagine how human minds could be so befuddled. The Little Red Book of Mao's citations has been published in 39 languages with a circulation of 3.5 billion copies. That's 5 books per person, including babies. This book of citations is a must, a guideline for all occasions. Here are samples of Mao's sayings. The movement for regulating the style is an overall movement for Marxist education, or you won't succeed without a super effort. These so-called thoughts aren't unusual, but the people must find the answer to all their problems in these abstract replies. And they're having a hard time to make head or tail of it. The peasants, alarmed over their crops. The doctors, before an operation. The seamen, in their morning prayers to the great helmsman. The children, instead of playing and laughing. The soldiers, while on the march or resting, or when visiting their families. Everywhere this little red book is essential. Behind this deliberate haste are such demands. Don't try to think. Believe in Chairman Mao blindly, as you would in a god, and just try to disobey. An overseer will tear off your dog's head. The whole system of Mao Zedong's personality cult, all the religious fuss over his name, serves to prevent the Chinese from thinking of what is happening. Isn't that why millions on Fu Weibin are told not to read books? Mao told them. The more books you read, the more stupid you become. He also said, you won't become an emperor by reading books.
Okay, so that was the first one that I had that I got from YouTube. Got another one here that's longer. This one's about roughly 17 minutes. And so this one, maybe, this is also just obviously from a documentary.
In the aftermath, Mao kept to the side and let the president, Liu Shaoqi, run the country. Even Mao knew that the economy had to be protected from his revolutionary zeal for the time being. So more cautious targets were set. Large communes were abandoned. Chinese peasants were allowed some land again and could sell their produce in free markets. They were allowed to live as families and return to something near normal life. There were fewer slogans. But Mao was biding his time. He worried his revolution was going off the boil. He saw a privileged bureaucratic class emerging, as had happened in the Soviet Union. He feared the return of capitalism and materialist incentives. He believed China's chance to have a perfect socialist society was passing. Mao's supporters printed a book of quotations from his political speeches and writing and used them as the basis for a new attack on what was called the capitalist road. "We still have to wage a protracted struggle against bourgeois and petty bourgeois ideology," said Mao. As he tried to regain power, Mao used a piece of spectacular political showmanship to revive his reputation. To demonstrate his continuing vigor, at the age of 72, he led a mass swim across the River Yangtze. Trying to break the thinking and attitudes of old China, he began with her traditional culture. The thousand-year-old Beijing Opera was singled out as the start of his attack. If it could be changed, then anything could be. 8 new revolutionary plays were written to replace all the old stories of emperors and concubines. Tung Shangling, who once played princes, now took the lead as an officer in the People's Army.
I was chosen to play this revolutionary role, and it was a great honor. As artists, we were engineers of human souls. We didn't just perform to earn money, but had a serious responsibility to re-educate people. We were so happy that Chairman Mao was creatively involved in this opera.
By late 1966, the great proletarian cultural revolution was well underway. The group behind it, led by Mao's wife, and later to be called the Gang of Four, tried to build the Mao cult to new heights. In school, children recited his message to them. In Shanghai, at the number 6 girls' school, Xiao Ailing was the headmistress.
Our students just noticed the change in the The pupils came to realize that all the changes taking place in their families, at school, in Shanghai and China, were brought about by Chairman Mao.
Students were used to carry the Cultural Revolution forward. For the first time, young people were encouraged to attack authority and the old hierarchy of the party. And the advice came from Mao himself. Bombard the headquarters, he said. To rebel is justified. One of the Beijing students who were the first to call themselves Red Guards was Zhang Baoqing.
Chairman Mao started the Cultural Revolution to keep up the momentum for change. Everything he said was right. We thought if we follow Mao, we can't go wrong. Only he can lead us from one victory to another.
A succession of huge rallies were held in Tiananmen Square. The master of mass mobilization had shown he could still draw a political response directly from the people. This time it wasn't the peasants in the country who did his bidding. The most educated and energetic generation in China were following his every word. The students felt excited and liberated as never before. An estimated 11 million Red Guards came to see Mao. 15-year-old Zhao Shouyun was presented to him.
I was so overwhelmed by the excitement, my mind just went blank. The only thing I wanted to do was to get a good look at Chairman Mao and shake his hand if I got the chance. I shook hands with him three times because I'd been received by Chairman Mao. Millions of Red Guards regarded me with awe. When they saw me, they always wanted to shake the hand that Chairman Mao had shaken. The rising fervor was directed at Mao's rivals, including President Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping. Banners attacked Liu. Even small children were taught to denounce Liu. The rage was extended to foreign governments, with attacks on Western diplomats in Beijing. Almost anyone who was in power of any kind was denounced as a capitalist roader. The whole structure of the party was brought down, including Zhong Guodong, the district secretary in Tianjin.
In all the previous campaigns, I'd been singling people out and telling them their mistakes. I was the one who found fault with them. I didn't expect the tables to be turned on me this time round.
Mao 对这个组织派呢，特别恨。
Some of the biggest high school students, who were very loyal to Chairman Mao, pressed my head down, twisted both my hands behind my back, and made me bend over throughout the denunciation meeting. I didn't think I'd survive.
In Sichuan, Luo Shufa, the party secretary who'd helped his village through the famine, was denounced.
I didn't expect the Cultural Revolution would affect me. Why should it? I knew I hadn't done anything wrong, and always had the support of the people. At the denunciation meeting, they slapped my face and forced me to kneel down. Kneeling on hot charcoal and broken glass was almost a daily routine. So what I did was to put a soft pad inside my trousers, and that made it easier when I was forced to my knees.
In schools, pupils attacked their teachers.
Our headmaster had been really good to us, but even he couldn't escape. We didn't hate him personally, but he represented bourgeois values, so we had to attack him. We dragged our headmaster onto the school stage, then students put a dunce's cap on his head and a big placard around his neck. The more extreme we were, the more loyal we felt to Chairman Mao.
In Shanghai, the teacher who had taught her class to love Mao was now accused of being disloyal.
There were several hundred Red Guards wearing armbands. Others had military belts. Some had scissors in their hands ready to cut people's hair. They chopped off my hair and beat me with sticks. They ordered me to produce the Red Book and to recite that revolution means rebellion and violence. That day I was wearing a white shirt without pockets, so I wasn't carrying the Red Book with me. They said, if you're not carrying the Red Book, that means you aren't loyal to Chairman Mao. How dare you say you love Chairman Mao? You deserve to be overthrown. It was December in Shanghai and very cold. They ordered me to stand outside in the playground from morning till night. But then they thought the punishment wasn't severe enough. So they got a big blackboard and pressed it down on me. One of them stood on the right side and one on the left, like a seesaw. And I was squashed in the middle. They wanted to knock me down and keep me down forever.
Chao Ailing was left with permanent injuries to her face. Up to 1 million were killed or driven to suicide. The country was now in the grip of a revolutionary mania that became more and more violent and destructive. The Red Guards attacked the four olds. Old habits, old ideas, old customs, old culture. Books were burnt and museums pillaged. Soon, rival factions of Red Guards fought one another.
We used clubs and guns. Many were beaten until they bled, others died. But we all felt we were the true defenders of Chairman Mao's revolution. To die for the great leader was an honor.
The anarchy spread. Schools and hospitals closed. Offices and factories were in chaos.
The factory almost came to a standstill. Production was impossible. We had meetings every day and workers were denounced. We didn't know what to do. One day, you'd be arrested, and the next day it would be my turn. We didn't know what would happen to the country. Many workers committed suicide by jumping in front of trains or into the river.
The attempt at a state of continuous revolution was impossible to keep up. People craved the return of a more normal, stable life. After 2 years, the army had to be called in to end the factional fighting, restore order, and help to re-establish the party's authority. And the Red Guards were sent to the countryside to cool off and learn from the peasants. But the Cultural Revolution only ended with Mao himself in 1976. In a bid to keep the country together, the propagandists exploited the scenes of mass emotion on Mao's death. Much of the grief was genuine, and many had seen their lives improve beyond measure. But many millions had suffered or died as victims of Mao's rhetoric. All his charisma hadn't delivered the new society he'd promised.
Okay, so that should serve as a lesson to us today, but of course, for many of us, regardless of how smart we think we are or not, for many of us, it simply gets dismissed or it falls on deaf ears. So, for a lot of people, they're, you know, the only thing that can teach them is to suffer. And we are kind of running headlong right into that. So anyway, I've got one more piece of audio that I want to play, and this is a piece about China's empty cities.
Welcome back. A question for you. Which of our stories has received the most number of hits online? Well, the undisputed winner with a staggering 3 million hits is a story by Adrian Brown in 2011, which looked at the new cities springing up all over China with almost no one in them. Are they part of a massive property bubble that's about to burst? Or do the Mandarins in Beijing have a very, very big plan for the future? Adrian has been back to China to try and find out.
The Chinese don't have to go to Paris anymore. It's come to them. This is the district of Tianjucheng in Xinjiang province. A bizarre mix of Parisian townhouses, fountains from the Palace of Versailles, and an Eiffel Tower clone, a third the size of the original. It's an incongruous scene, a place where China's aspirations and traditions collide.
Vous parlez français?
On me dit Pietà.
Vous parlez français? Vous parlez
français? 挺有意思的.
But just like my French, this architectural clone has gone badly wrong. On Champs-Élysées Square, just about every shop stands abandoned. Tianju Cheng is proving popular with wedding photographers. But the Parisian vibe hasn't quite proved to be the attraction it was meant to be. 10,000 people were supposed to live here. Today, the population's a tenth of that. At a local noodle bar, I find Wu Xixing serving up the lunchtime noodles. She's tried to make a go of it for the last year and a half, but is worried about how long her business can stay afloat. It's possible, of course, that more people will move in and the shops will reopen. But for now, Tianju Cheng is another of China's ghost cities.
On it goes, every shop empty, boarded up. Amazing.
In the southern city of Dongguan, I've returned to the vast and crumbling South China Mall. It claims to be the world's biggest shopping center. It's also the emptiest.
Nothing has changed in the 2.5 years since I was last in the Great Mall of China.
I last reported from here in 2011. Back then, I found toy shop owner Tianyu Gao trying desperately to make a go of it.
Do you get very lonely in here?
来那边看铺咧，系有啲无聊噶，客人太少啦。
When was the last time you sold something?
琴日啊，琴日都有买一个，有时几日都有噶，另一日都有。
Today, Mr. Tian's old shop is boarded up. He didn't survive. But the shopping center could yet prosper. The local government has taken over, classifying it as a national tourist attraction. Billions of dollars are being spent on a makeover that includes a massive apartment and villa complex. The aim is to turn this miserable mall into a new town. It's a build, build, build mentality that has some high-ranking officials concerned.
肯定要进行及时的调整它的发展思路，特别是要矫正地方政府的一种发展的一种对推动城市化一种这种盲目赶超借鉴一种行为。
Li Tai heads the country's top economic planning agency. For such an influential figure, his language is refreshingly frank.
大量的城市呢，它取决于长官的主观意志、偏好。当他去了欧洲，去了美国以后，看到美国很好的形态，希望原封不动的搬到中国来，来显示我们中国的建设风格，或者显示中国在这种城市化发展中赶超心理。那我们可能更多的可能是追求表面上的城市化。
For the ultimate display of rampant and unchecked urbanization, I've come to Inner
Mongolia. That's a whole city over there, isn't it?
To the city of Kangbashi in the sprawling district of Ordos. 8:30 a.m. peak hour on the main road into China's largest and most infamous ghost city. In the middle of a mining boom, developers were given free rein here. This is where Genghis Khan meets Alice in Wonderland. Complete with a yellow brick road to nowhere. People may be at a premium here, but space is not. When the short-lived mining boom went to bust, the influx of new residents never came. Designed to accommodate 1 million residents, today the population is reportedly less than 70,000. Driving around this city is an eerie and unsettling experience. Everywhere apartments stand empty, office blocks remain half finished, and the cranes are idle.
I think the problem in Ordos is that things just took off, they went completely crazy.
Author Tom Miller has written a book on China's urban explosion and why places like Ordos have failed.
The kinds of population pressures Ordos imagined they would have not come to pass. And so, yes, in Ordos, there's going to be an awful lot of waste.
When you travel around China, as I have done, and you see all these empty apartment blocks, you know, houses that haven't been lived in, are we seeing the signs of a property bubble that's beginning to burst?
And I think there are certainly bubbles within China, but the point is that China's a very, very large country, and it doesn't make sense to talk about a single bubble. I think it's, imagine China as bubble wrap. Some of those bubbles within it might burst, but in places like, say, Beijing and Shanghai, there's still massive, massive demand for housing, and there isn't enough housing.
It's the area's lack of people that, ironically, is drawing in the visitors. Some have come a long way to see for themselves the emptiest city in the world's most populated country.
Oh, it's tourists.
Hello.
Hi.
Where are you from?
From Iraq.
From Iraq?
Yeah. What about you?
From Australia.
It'll be a while before the tourists come here, though. 850 kilometres south of Ordos, they're building another city from scratch. In Gansu province, in China's arid west, Langzhou New Area is taking shape. It's a project that began with military precision just 2 years ago, when army engineers cut the tops of 700 mountains and filled in the valleys. And this is what they're building. A 130,000 hectare metropolis. This project is all part of China's ambitious goal to move more than 400 million people from the countryside to the city in the next 10 years. It is perhaps only China that could contemplate something on this almost unimaginable scale. Since the turn of the century, China's urban population has grown by a mind-boggling 220 million people. The government is gambling that cities that are empty now will in time start to fill up.
If you travel around China, you will find lots of empty places, and if you come back 5 years later, you'll find that they filled up. And this is a standard pattern of development in China, and it's very, very different from the way development works in almost any other country in the world.
Thank you very much for inviting us to your new city.
Gu Shijiang is Lanzhou New Area's deputy mayor. He insists his city will not make the same mistakes as Ordos. The foundations of a new life are taking shape by the day. Lanzhou will soon become home for thousands of rural migrants from the city's sprawling hinterland.
This is 另外高层住宅呢主要是满足这个大量的就是这个刚性需求啊，需要来这去居住，在新区创业置业啊，在这需要居住的人群。
Before we left Lanzhou, the deputy mayor had some people he wanted us to meet.
We've been invited here by the local government and they're basically organizing all of our interviews. Now we're being taken to meet some local farmers who are having to leave their land to make way for this new city.
These farmers have had no say in their relocation, but with government minders in earshot, all insist they're glad to be moving. For men who've worked the fields much of their lives, the big challenge will be to find work in the city.
I suppose in a way it's not difficult to see why these people are happy to move, but it's always hard to know whether they're saying what they really mean when you've got government minders all around you. And look here, you can see the demolition work has already begun. And soon, all this will be one vast construction site.
I asked to see one of the next houses on the demolition list and quickly discovered it was only built 10 years ago.
What's wrong with this? This seems all right. Why does it have to be knocked down?
But a lot of farmers, the house like this.
And yet they're going to be knocked down?
Yes. Ah.
For the owner, the gain of a new apartment will mean losing his family home.
Will your apartment be bigger than this?
Across China, millions more are making the move from the country to the city. It's social engineering on the grandest of scales.
Adrian Brown in China, and that plan to move more than 400 million people into those new areas simply beggars belief. Our website has a blog from Adrian about the rather mixed reaction from Chinese authorities to his visit, and there's a revealing interactive satellite view of the deserted streets. Plus, see his original report from 2011, which, as I mentioned, has been viewed over 3 million times. That's at sbs.com.au/dateline.
Okay, so there was the thing about the empty cities. Now, I would suggest you watch that video. You can find it on YouTube. It's about, you know, China, empty cities. It's this Dateline, but it's Dateline. It's an Australian. It's a clip from Australian TV. And so the reason you should watch that is because the parts where the people were speaking in Chinese, of course, they were throwing the words up on the screen in English, and you know, instead of having a translator talk over it, they were just kind of putting it up on, you know, in English on the screen. And I don't like it when they do that. Or there's a lot of times where I'm, you know, laying in bed watching movies, you know, and they'll have a part, like documentary or whatever, and they'll be interviewing somebody that speaks a different language. And instead of just having a narrator either read or say what the people are saying, they will, you know, if you're trying to sleep or whatever, or you're just, you know, you're trying to watch television that way, it's really annoying. I wish they would, that people would kind of get away from that. Or another favorite thing is to throw words up on the screen, you know, like as a, instead of just having a, you know, to kind of tell part of the story, they just put words up on the screen every so often, and then you have these different segments, and it sort of like divides the segments up. So, you know, you have a paragraph of words. Well, that's kind of useless because it kind of, you know, it sort of forces you to read the screen. And if you can devote your full attention to it, that's all well and good. But if you're just listening to the audio, for example, it's kind of, you know, it doesn't work so well. So I don't know. I'm a big fan. You know, I think that if, you know, like on a movie like this or a documentary or whatever, they should make the audio, make it so that you can just listen to the, listen to the audio and kind of get the full story, you know, and then the video is kind of icing on the cake, you know, but... I don't know. They have this different people that produce these things have different ideas about how they want to do it. So, but anyway, you can find that pretty easily online if you just go to youtube.com. What I did, I typed in China Cultural Revolution, and that's how I found this. But you could type in China Empty Cities for this one that we just listened to. So, anyhow, I think I need to cut this off. Get headed to bed. Hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.